Chapter 25. Pottery, and came up to the railway. The down train came along close to me, and there, sitting at a carriage window, I saw my wife. As he had found out my address, and had thereupon determined to follow me here. I had not been home many minutes before she came in. Next morning early she left again apostrophe, because you treated her so cavalierly? Apostrophe, apostrophe, and as I suppose, wrote to you directly. That's the whole story of her, madam. Apostrophe, apostrophe, whatever were Manston's real feelings towards the lady who had received his explanation in these supercilious tones, they remained locked within him, as within a casket of steel. Did your friends know of your marriage, Mr. Manston? Apostrophe, apostrophe, she continued. Nobody at all. We kept it a secret for various reasons. Apostrophe, apostrophe, it is true then that, as your wife tells me in this letter, as he has not passed as Mrs. Manston till within these last few days? Apostrophe, apostrophe, it is quite true. I was in receipt of a very small and uncertain income when we married, and so she continued playing at the theater, as before our marriage, and in her maiden name. Apostrophe, apostrophe, has she any friends? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I have never heard that as he has any in England. She came over here on some theatrical speculation, as one of a company who were going to do much, but who never did anything, and here as he has remained. Apostrophe, apostrophe, a pause ensued, which was terminated by Miss Aldclyffe. I understand, apostrophe, she said. Now, though I have no direct right to concern myself with your private affairs beyond those which arise from your misleading me, and getting the office you hold, apostrophe, as to that, madam, apostrophe, he interrupted, rather oddly, as to coming here, I am vexed as much as you. Somebody, a member of the Institute of Architects who, I could never tell, sent to my old address in London your advertisement cut from the paper. It was forwarded to me. I wanted to get away from Liverpool, and it seemed as if this was put in my way on purpose, by some old friend or other. I answered the advertisement, certainly, but I was not particularly anxious to come here, nor am I anxious to stay. Apostrophe, apostrophe, Miss Aldclyffe descended from haughty superiority to womanly persuasion with a haste which was almost ludicrous. Indeed, the quasi-ego of the whole lecture had been less the genuine menace of the imperious ruler of Knapwater than an artificial utterance, to hide a failing heart. Now, now, Mr. Manston, you're on me. Don't suppose I wish to be overbearing, or anything of the kind. And you will allow me to say this much, at any rate, that I have become interested in your wife, as well as in yourself. Apostrophe, apostrophe, certainly, madam, apostrophe, he said, slowly, like a man feeling his way in the dark. Manston was utterly at fault now. His previous experience of the effect of his form and features upon womankind en masse had taught him to flatter himself that he could account by the same law of natural selection for the extraordinary interest Miss Aldclyffe had hitherto taken in him as an unmarried man. An interest he did not at all object to, seeing that it kept him near Cytherea, and enabled him, a man of no wealth, to rule on the estate, as if he were its lawful owner. Like Curius at his Sabin farm, he had counted it his glory, not to possess gold himself, but to have power over her who did. But at this hint of the lady's wish to take his wife under her wing also, he was perplexed. Could she have any sinister motive in doing so? But he did not allow himself to be troubled with these doubts, which only concerned his wife's happiness. She tells me, apostrophe, continued Miss Aldclyffe, how utterly alone in the world she stands, and that is an additional reason why I should sympathize with her. Instead, then, of requesting the favor of your retirement from the post, and dismissing your interests altogether, I will retain you as my steward still, on condition that you bring home your wife, and live with her respectably, in short, as if you loved her, you understand. I wish you to stay here, if you grant that everything shall flow smoothly between yourself and her. ..., the breast and shoulders of the steward rose, as if an expression of defiance was about to be poured forth. Before it took form, he controlled himself and said, in his natural voice, "My part of the performance shall be carried out, madam." ..., and her anxiety to obtain a standing in the world ensures that hers will, ..., replied Miss Aldcliffe. "That will be satisfactory, then." ..., after a few additional remarks, she gently signified that she wished to put an end to the interview. The steward took the hint and retired. He felt vexed and mortified. Yet in walking homeward he was convinced that telling the whole truth as he had done, with the single exception of his love for Cytherea which he tried to hide even from himself, had never served him in better stead than it had done that night. Manston went to his desk and thought of Cytherea's beauty with the bitterest, wildest regret. After the lapse of a few minutes he calmed himself by a stoical effort, and wrote the subjoined letter to his wife. "Knapwater, November 21, 1864. Dear Eunice, I hope you reached London safely after your flighty visit to me. As I promised, I have thought over our conversation that night, and your wish that your coming here should be no longer delayed. After all, it was perfectly natural that you should have spoken unkindly as you did, ignorant as you were of the circumstances which bound me. So I have made arrangements to fetch you home at once. It is hardly worth while for you to attempt to bring with you any luggage you may have gathered about you beyond mere clothing. Dispose of superfluous things at a broker's. Your bringing them would only make a talk in this parish, and lead people to believe we had long been keeping house separately. Will next Monday suit you for coming? You have nothing to do that can occupy you for more than a day or two, as far as I can see, and the remainder of this week will afford ample time. I can be in London the night before, and we will come down together by the midday train. Your very affectionate husband, Enias Manston." Now, of course, I shall no longer write to you as Mrs. Rondley. ..., the address on the envelope was Mrs. Manston, 41 Charles Square, Hoxton, London, N. He took the letter to the house, and it being too late for the country post, sent one of the stablemen with it to Casterbridge, instead of troubling to go to Budmouth with it himself as heretofore. He had no longer any necessity to keep his condition a secret. 7. From the 22nd to the 27th of November, but the next morning Manston found that he had been forgetful of another matter in naming the following Monday to his wife for the journey. The fact was this. A letter had just come, reminding him that he had left the whole of the succeeding week open for an important business engagement with a neighboring land agent at that gentleman's residence 13 miles off. The particular day he had suggested to his wife had, in the interim, been appropriated by his correspondent. The meeting could not now be put off. So he wrote again to his wife, stating that business, which could not be postponed, called him away from home on Monday, and would entirely prevent him coming all the way to fetch her on Sunday night as he had intended, but that he would meet her at the Carriford Road station with a conveyance when she arrived there in the evening. The next day came his wife's answer to his first letter, in which she said that she would be ready to be fetched at the time named. Having already written his second letter, which was by that time in her hands, he made no further reply. The week passed away. The steward had, in the meantime, let it become generally known in the village that he was a married man, and by a little judicious management, sound family reasons for his past secrecy upon the subject, which were floated as adjuncts to the story, were placidly received. They seemed so natural and justifiable to the unsophisticated minds of 9/10 of his neighbors, that curiosity in the matter, beyond a strong curiosity, to see the lady's face, was well nigh extinguished. X. The events of a day and night. 1. November the 28th. Until 10 p. Monday came, the day named for Mrs. Manston's journey from London to her husband's house, a day of singular and great events, influencing the present and future of nearly all the personages whose actions in the complex drama form the subject of this record. The proceedings of the steward demand the first notice. Whilst taking his breakfast on this particular morning, the clock pointing to 8, the horse and gig that was to take him to Chettlewood waiting ready at the door, Manston hurriedly cast his eyes down the column of Bradshaw which showed the details and duration of the selected train's journey. The inspection was carelessly made, the leaf being kept open by the aid of one hand, whilst the other still held his cup of coffee. Much more carelessly than would have been the case had the expected newcomer been Cytherea Gray, instead of his lawful wife. He did not perceive, branching from the column down which his finger ran, a small twist, called a shunting line, inserted at a particular place, to imply that at that point the train was divided into two. By this oversight he understood that the arrival of his wife at Carriford Road Station would not be till late in the evening. By the second half of the train, containing the third-class passengers, and passing 2 hours and three-quarters later than the previous one, by which the lady, as a second-class passenger, would really be brought. He then considered that there would be plenty of time for him to return from his day's engagement to meet this train. He finished his breakfast, gave proper and precise directions to his servant on the preparations that were to be made for the lady's reception, jumped into his gig, and drove off to Lord Claydonfield's, at Chettlewood. He went along by the front of Knapwater House. He could not help turning to look at what he knew to be the window of Cytherea's room. Whilst he looked, a hopeless expression of passionate love and sensuous anguish came upon his face, and lingered there for a few seconds. Then, as on previous occasions, it was resolutely repressed, and he trotted along the smooth white road, again endeavoring to banish all thought of the young girl whose beauty and grace had so enslaved him. Thus it was that when, in the evening of the same day, Mrs. Manston reached Carriford Road Station, her husband was still at Chettlewood, ignorant of her arrival, and on looking up and down the platform, dreary with autumn gloom and wind, she could see no sign that any preparation, whatever had been made for her reception and conduct home. The train went on. She waited, fidgeted with the handle of her umbrella, walked about, strained her eyes into the gloom of the chilly night, listened for wheels, tapped with her foot, and showed all the usual signs of annoyance and irritation. She was the more irritated in that this seemed a second and culminating instance of her husband's neglect, the first having been shown in his not fetching her. Reflecting a while upon the course it would be best to take, in order to secure a passage to Knapwater, she decided to leave all her luggage, except a dressing bag, in the cloakroom, and walk to her husband's house, as he had done on her first visit. She asked one of the porters if he could find a lad to go with her and carry her bag. He offered to do it himself. The porter was a good-tempered, shallow-minded, ignorant man. Mrs. Manston, being apparently in very gloomy spirits, would probably have preferred walking beside him without saying a word. But her companion would not allow silence to continue between them for a longer period than 2 or 3 minutes together. He had volunteered several remarks upon her arrival, chiefly to the effect that it was very unfortunate Mr. Manston had not come to the station for her, when she suddenly asked him concerning the inhabitants of the parish. He told her categorically the names of the chief, first the chief possessors of property, then of brains, then of good looks. As first among the latter he mentioned Miss Cytherea Gray. After getting him to describe her appearance as completely as lay in his power, she wormed out of him the statement that everybody had been saying before Mrs. Manston's existence was heard, of how well the handsome Mr. Manston and the beautiful Miss Gray were suited for each other as man and wife, and that Miss Aldclyffe was the only one in the parish who took no interest in bringing about the match. He rather liked her, you think? ..." The porter began to think he had been too explicit, and hastened to correct the error. "Oh no, he don't care a bit about her, ma'am," he said solemnly. "Not more than he does about me?"
"Not a bit."
"Then that must be little indeed," Mrs. Manston murmured. She stood still, as if reflecting upon the painful neglect her words had recalled to her mind. Then, with a sudden impulse, turned round, and walked petulantly a few steps back again in the direction of the station. The porter stood still and looked surprised.
"I'll go back again. Yes, indeed, I'll go back again."
She said plaintively. Then she paused and looked anxiously up and down the deserted road. "No, I mustn't go back now," she continued, in a tone of resignation. Seeing that the porter was watching her, she turned about, and came on as before, giving vent to a slight laugh. It was a laugh full of character, the low-forced laugh which seeks Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.